Hello and welcome to the Painting Podcast. I'm your host, Jeremiah Polacek, your co-pilot on the pathway to becoming a better painter or a better art lover in general. Today we're going to be talking about Austrian Expressionist Egon Schiele. We'll explore his groundbreaking artwork, discuss the influential figures in his life, and reflect on the impact he had on those around him and the art world he left behind. So I think anybody interested in figurative painting has an Egon Schiele moment. For me, I was about 17 years old, and my father used to bring back these big art books from the library. So we would have, you know, one of these giant art books. Every month we'd have a different one. And one month he came home with the Egon Schiele book, and I was about 17 years old, listening to Nirvana and all this sort of stuff. And Egon Schiele was exactly the artist that I was looking for when I first saw him. I thought, this is exactly how I want to paint or draw. It's so full of angst and expressionistic, contorted forms. And I think a lot of people have this Egon Schiele moment where they first see his artwork and are really struck by just how evocative it is. But then you end up reading a little bit more about Schiele, the person, and we're presented with this dilemma where an artist or an individual is engaged in some really horrific, reprehensible acts and how that affects the way we view the work. So to get it out of the way in the beginning of the podcast, Egon Schiele was obsessed with his younger sister and almost certainly had inappropriate relations with her. So if that's something that makes you unable to look at his artwork, then you might want to stop the podcast now. But diving into people's personal lives often uncovers these types of skeletons in the closet. And it really is a question about how we can consume art across the board that is made by people we probably wouldn't hang out with, probably wouldn't get a beer with, probably would think was a creep. But they end up making these beautiful, beautiful drawings and paintings. How do we deal with that? So for this podcast, I'll deal with it the same way I would any other artist. I'll look at his life, where he grew up, who influenced him, and all the usual things. Let's get into it. Egon Schiele was born in 1890 in this little village called Tulln, located in Austria, and his dad had German heritage, and his mother, Maria, had Czech heritage. However, if we dissect the Czech heritage, a lot of Czechoslovakia at the time, or Bohemia, which is where she came from, a lot of the people there would also speak German. So things get very, very complicated when discussing nationality in this region. However, his mom was from the town Český Krumlov, and she was Czech, and the father was German. So Egon grows up in this tiny, beautiful little town, and his father actually has a really good job. He's like the manager of all the trains. So he has all these It's a pretty important duty to have in the community. And so they were pretty well off, respected members. And Egon, from a very young age, took to drawing trains. He became obsessed with trains from a very young age. Now, there's all sorts of stereotypes with young boys who are obsessed with trains. I won't get into that. But his early drawings almost solely focused on drawing trains, the tracks, how they moved, these sorts of things. And he filled up sketchbooks full of train drawings. Now, his father was not really into Egon's obsession with drawing trains, so what did he do? He destroyed his sketchbooks. He ripped them up in front of him, ripped up his drawings, threw them away in the garbage. Obviously, this did not work. At age 11, Egon would move with his family to a nearby city called Krems. And these aren't, you know, when I said village before, these aren't little rinky-dink villages. But now I checked on the current population. It's around 25,000 people. So back then, we can imagine that this is a larger city in the region. And he moves to this new town. And from all accounts, he's very shy. He's not really talking to many of his classmates. He fails many of his classes consistently, so much that he's held behind. So now he's in, you know, older than everybody else in the classroom as well. But he did really well in athletics and drawing. Those were the two things he was actually quite good at. and he would continue here in Krems for a few more years. And at the age of 14, his father would die of syphilis, and Egon would have to become like a ward of his maternal uncle, Leopold Cihacek. And he was also, this is his uncle, and his uncle was also a big railway guy. So he really wanted Egon to also just get a normal job. Obviously, there was a lot of nepotism involved in who worked for the railway company, and he would be set up. He could probably get a normal job and have a normal life. But there was no denying how prodigious Egon was, and he even convinced his uncle, Leopold, to get him a tutor at 14 years old. So he would begin studying with a local artist, Ludwig Karl Strauch, and he's 14 years old now at the time. So he probably did, you know, some pretty typical academic sort of exercises and these sorts of things with Ludwig, and had his normal weekly tutoring sessions where they would show each other their drawings. He'd get critiqued on them, composition, color, all these sorts of things. And then in 1906, Sheila would apply to the School of Arts and Crafts in Vienna, and this is where Gustav Klimt had once studied as well. And he'd get in. He'd get into the School of Arts and Crafts. But within his first year there, all the faculty members basically got together and were like, we have to get rid of this kid, and he's got to go to this traditional art academy, which is also in Vienna. So he kind of gets kicked out of the School of Arts and Crafts, and he gets sent to this more traditional academy. And his main teacher here is a man named Christian Greipenkerl. It's the best I can do. And Mr. Greipenkerl is a painter who has like this very old school academic approach. We're thinking, you know, French Academy in the 1890s, Bouguereau, this sort of stuff. And this really frustrated Egon because he's completely uninterested in all this sort of stuff. He's more interested in expressionism and artists like Gustav Klimt, who he's obviously kind of trying to follow in his footsteps, but he ends up in this academy, you know, making drawings of casts of hands or something like that. And that's not where his passion is, and that's not what he sees art as. This idea of art existing kind of as a placeholder of history for rich people is the furthest thing from his imagination or mind. So technically, he's got a lot of issues with what he's being taught at this academy, but conceptually, he's also got a major issue with what he's being taught. So he lasts there about 3 years, and then he just quits. So the first academy, the School of Arts and Crafts, kicks him out more or less. You have to imagine what else was going on for them all to agree that he had to go. And then the academy is also not a place for him. So he's kind of a loner in this respect. He's not fitting in anywhere, really. And that's his story for his entire life, really, is one of not fitting in. Even if he's an 11-year-old in school making drawings of trains, you know, in a classroom full of kids 2 years younger than him because he's failed multiple years, he's somebody outside of society, outside of everyone else. And that leads to an extremely unique vision. However, if we look at the early drawings that Sheila was doing, you know, he does this self-portrait in 1906, so he would be 16 years old at the time, and it still is a pretty straightforward charcoal drawing of himself. There's not a lot of this angsty line work and these sort of expressionistic elements coming out of it. So he really is somebody who's looking a lot, and he's very, very well trained at looking and replicating reality. So I think that's an important thing to consider, that, you know, he's not making these, you know, signature drawings when he's 14 years old. He's making kind of academic work. So in 1907, he's 17 years old now, he's going to hunt down his idol, Gustav Klimt. And he gets lucky because Klimt likes him, as he does a lot of other younger artists. And what Klimt does is kind of amazing in many respects, because he's mentoring him, but he's also buying his drawings so he can make a living somewhat at this young age. And he's introducing him to models and places he can draw. You know, all the basics of making artwork is being facilitated through Gustav, his new mentor. And arguably, this is a much better education than what he would have got at the Academy of Arts, regurgitating, you know, these academic paintings of people on swings or something. So he's in the art world from an extremely young age with a great guide who has amazing connections. And Egan's work takes a dramatic change at this period, and it begins to resemble Klimt's work in a lot of ways. And remember, when we think about Gustav Klimt, we're coming out of Art Nouveau, and Art Nouveau, you know, if we look at somebody like Mucha, the Czech artist Mucha, or Gustav Klimt, you know, both from the exact same region as well. And Egan Schiele is also part of this trajectory, albeit a little bit later. So when we look at the line work of somebody like Mucha, it almost looks like a comic book in some ways. It's a lot different than what we're seeing in these types of paintings where we're interested in edges and large shapes and values. In Art Nouveau, we're really, really concerned with line. And that's something that becomes very important in Egan's work as well, is this line and how expressive we can be with a line itself. And it becomes more about drawing in many respects than painting. And there's really an illustrative quality to Art Nouveau works. And so that's a good way to position the way we look at Egan's works as well, as one fitting into a tradition of Art Nouveau artists. But as always, Egan is on the outside of everything, and thankfully Gustav is a smart enough mentor to basically say, hey, you need to stop emulating me and find your own voice. And so he kind of nurtures Egan's own natural voice out of him. And by 1909, Egan's already had a show. He had a show when he's 18 years old. And a year later, he'd found a group with some other disillusioned students from the academy. I imagine they were all getting beers together after class and just talking about their professors and how much they hated them. So they create their own new art group. And the name of the new art group is The New Group. I know, very creative. But we have to remember, this is 1909, and we're 4 years after the birth of Expressionism. We would get the art group in Dresden called The Bridge, with painters like Kirchner, who would become extremely influential painters. So this isn't exactly operating in a vacuum. This is 1909. It's 4 years after The Bridge has been invented. But these painters must all know about this other stuff going on. I'm sure they were cued into it. And that only made them more and more discontent with their current surroundings in the academy. And there's not like a formal manifesto that was written, but the main goal of the new group was to infuse work with more psychological and emotional appeal rather than mimicry or these sorts of things. They really wanted to use the power of line, of paint, of gesture to tell an emotional story. If you're interested in seeing somebody else from this group, you can look at the work of Oskar Kokoschka as well, and you'll see these very vigorous, very energetic paintings, portrait paintings that he was doing as well at the time. So it's not so much as a way of creating a certain style of artwork. It's more of a way of thinking about paint, thinking about line, and the expressive nature of both of them. So in the same year, his mentor, Gustav Klimt, invites him into this group show, and in this show, he's going to be alongside a lot of other modernist masters, people like Vincent van Gogh and Edvard Munch, of course, where we see the seeds of Expressionism as well. So Egan's work is shown alongside all these other people's works, and this really helps him to break free from this academic past that had him really constrained in a lot of ways. And when he sees himself in the context of all these other works, it really gives him permission to fully explore what he wants to explore. And that is the human form, the human body, and how do we tell a story with it. And one of the signature things that he begins doing is something, you know, we've seen El Greco distort a neck or something like that, for instance. But the deformities that Egan is making cause bodies to get into all these sorts of contorted positions. And there's an overt sort of sexuality that is displayed as well. And these types of contortions and distortions in his drawings give us the ability to experience a more expressive drawing. And this is kind of a breakthrough thing at the time. You know, even if we're thinking about an Art Nouveau artist like Klimt or Mucha, for instance, in both of these works, there's really a refined crispness and elegance to them. And then Egan comes along, likely inspired by Munch and all these types of people, and he allows us to become crude and edges are not crisp and clear. You just use the charcoal and grind it into the paper. It doesn't matter if it, you know, the powder falls all over the place. We get this real guttural, expressive nature that we really haven't seen before. And it's not limited only to the human form either. There would be master copies that Egon would do as well at this time. Most notable is his painting of sunflowers after Van Gogh, or Van Gogh, I should say. And he also did a lot of landscapes, urban landscapes, and these sorts of things as well. And I think when we look at the construction of a landscape of a Schiele painting and a Van Gogh painting, we'll see a lot of similarities between the two in the way that the foreground, middle ground, and background are all kind of stacked on top of each other in this way. We can see a construction that is somewhat similar, and obviously that comes out in Egon's sunflowers painting, but it is an interesting corollary to think about between those two artists, and one that I haven't really seen fully investigated that much. So it's 1910, and Egon has embarked on a series of experimental works that would come to define his more mature signature style, and most of these are very provocative nudes that have these emaciated figures and kind of a haunted face of some sort, like sunken in features. And there's obviously a ton of sexual overtones as well. And, you know, it's 1910. He's only 20 years old, we have to remember. And he paints kneeling nude with raised hands. You can check out the image on your phone if you want to. And, you know, this becomes one of the most important figurative paintings of the 20th century. He's only 20 years old, and this is the beginning of this new way of creating paintings. I don't like using the term style, but this new approach to painting, and one that just spilled out of him early on. It just came right out and manifested itself onto the page, and he ends up creating one of the most revered and remembered paintings of the 20th century. But not everybody was exactly applauding the work of Egon, young Egon at the time, and a ton of people, art critics included, thought this is basically pornography. That's pretty much what they were saying. They were like, okay, we got Klimt, we got Mucha, you know, we can see some boobs, all right, that's cool. But this, what is going on? Why are we allowing this maniac to create these drawings and put them up on the walls? So there was a bit of an uproar about showing these paintings in public, as we would imagine, unfortunately, today, if we saw these, you know, I imagine if they had an exhibition in some cities in the United States, there would still be an uproar about these paintings that were done 110 years ago. But nonetheless, maybe we haven't progressed or we've regressed, but that's how it was in 1910 as well. They're like, what are you doing? Why are you making these paintings? And of course, while he's making all these paintings, he's doing something else too. Yeah, he's making portraits of kids. So yeah, that's the situation we're presented with. And a lot of people don't like that for really obvious reasons. But this examination of the human condition wasn't something completely out of place for the time. So we, you know, like Wittgenstein and who else? Wittgenstein and all those guys. Wittgenstein and who's the other one? Heidegger. They're still kids, right? They're still kids at the time. But somebody named Edmund Husserl would be the founder of phenomenology, and Husserl's work really focuses on this detailed description of the structures of experience and consciousness. And around 1910, he would be talking a lot about phenomenology. That's basically how we experience the world, this examination of how we experience the world. And this is one of the first times this discussion becomes public. And it's happening at the exact same time that Egon is also making his works. So while there was a lot of detractors and people who thought, you know, Schiele's work was pornographic and obscene, this, you know, the broader community was ready for it. They were ready and ripe to explore issues of sexuality and issues of human consciousness and these sorts of ideas, right at the same time that this is happening. And the people that want to censor Egon in some sort of way, they actually end up propelling his work and making it a lot more intriguing and making it a lot more popular because now people are talking about it. Oh, did you hear about the guy who's painting these terrible nudes with long arms wrapping them around? You know, like that makes the work more interesting and that propels him and makes him even more famous at a very young age. So he starts getting a lot of different shows. He has one in Prague, where I live. He has another one in Budapest. And he really becomes a leading figure of the avant-garde scene in Europe at the time. He's also closely linked to what is called the Vienna Secessionists. Now, who were the Vienna Secessionists? Basically, they're led by Klimt, and they're a group of artists. And they really believe that art can take multiple forms. They're known for, you know, doing architecture, doing sculpture, doing painting, but really rejecting an academic approach to art. And one of their most famous buildings is the Secession Building, located in Vienna. And this building has a motto written on it, and that is, "To every age, it's art. To art, it's freedom." And this really encapsulates the secessionists' philosophy of artistic freedom and innovation. They also had a magazine, which they published called Sacred Spring, and this would feature artworks, essays, and criticism that would promote their ideas and their own unique aesthetic vision. So things are going really, really well for Egon at his age. He's showing with internationally known groups, and he's considered a leading figure within one of them as well. And in 1911, Schiele's personal and professional life would take a significant turn when he would meet a 17-year-old Walburga Neuzil, who would go by Wally, and she would quickly become a central figure in his life and work. And Wally had previously modeled for Gustav Klimt and was also rumored to be one of his mistresses as well. But she became one of Schiele's companions and also his muse, and she would be featured in many of his most compelling and provocative paintings. Both of their relationships were shared by a desire for artistic and personal freedom, and they kind of wanted to get out of Vienna. They wanted to start over somewhere else. So, seeking a new start, Schiele and Wally would relocate to Český Krumlov, which is in southern Bohemia, current-day Czech Republic, and this is the place that Schiele's mother was born. He would move there. However, this would be met with resistance from the local community, which would disapprove of their unconventional lifestyle and Schiele's professional practice, especially continuing to use all these young teenage girls as his models. And this controversy would kind of reflect broader societal tensions around morality and art. And because of this, he would eventually have to leave Český Krumlov as well. So he gets run out of town and he moves to a new place that's right near Vienna called Neulingbach. And this is a place west of Vienna. And basically he just wants a nice place with beautiful surroundings and a cheap place to work because the capital is getting more expensive. So he's like, I want a cheap place. I just want to make my paintings. And this place, this studio, would attract a lot of delinquent children who would be running around the village, right? We see problems, don't we? Well, there was problems. And in 1912, he'd be 22 years old, he gets arrested for seducing a young girl who would be 13 years old. Now, the age of consent in Austria at the time would be 14 years old. So he's put under arrest, and they put him in jail. And after they put him in a jail cell, they go to his studio and they take all of these drawings, hundreds and hundreds of drawings they're taking from his studio. They're all evidence now, and they're considered pornographic. So Schiele's imprisoned and awaiting his trial, and his case is brought before a judge, and these charges end up getting dropped. I don't know why, but for some reason, the charges end up getting dropped. Now, the artist is found guilty of something else, though, and he's found guilty of making pornography in a place that is accessible to kids. And he's been in jail for like 21 days already, and they sentence him to 3 more days in jail, basically. So not exactly an extreme offense in any way, but nonetheless, the judge, he had a candle in the courtroom, and he actually burned one of the drawings in front of the court. So it's not difficult to really see the judge's perspective on Egan Schiele's paintings and drawings. Nonetheless, he's stuck in jail for around a month, and during this time, he creates a series of drawings, which you can look at as well, in his jail cell. So he spends his time in jail, he gets out, and he goes back to his studio, and across the street is this nice Protestant family and a young girl there named Edith. And basically, they're more of the, you know, the same age. And Egan, I don't know what he's thinking, but for some reason, he decides he wants to get married. And so he basically says, I'm going to marry Edith from across the street. It's kind of a marriage of convenience, but we can do the whole thing and I can, you know, be a normal functioning member of society. And Wally is kind of, that's his other girlfriend, Wally is kind of this free spirit, and she's just not having it. She's like, okay, see you later then. Bye. And so she goes, and Egan ends up marrying the nice normal girl next door. So he's married for 3 days, and what happens? World War I happens, and so Schiele gets called to serve, and he's got to go to Prague. They're like, sorry, you've got to go to war. And even though he's showing at the time, he's a well-known figure, but there's no discrimination at this point. He's got to go. So he ships off to Prague with his new wife, Edith, and he has to live in this giant, you know, where all the soldiers live, barracks, and Edith stays in a local hotel. Maybe he's making money. I suppose he's probably got good money if he's showing and selling his paintings throughout Europe. He's probably getting something. So his wife is in a hotel and he's in the barracks, and he's tasked with transporting all these Russian soldiers. And he basically has to make sure people don't run away, get them from point A to point B, these sort of things. And he's, you know, unsurprisingly, he's not the best at it. You look at a picture of this guy from, you know, 1915, He's a skinny, nerdy art kid that they gave a gun to and was like, hey, take those prisoners over there. He's like, all right. So he's not exactly the best at this job, but he is good at other things, and he's got great handwriting, which comes in handy. So he gets more of a desk job, and he does really well at this job. And he's surrounded by all these prisoners. However, it's all men. All of a sudden, it's all men everywhere. Before, we had all these young women. Now he's got all these gruff men in their 20s. So he starts painting military officers, all these sorts of things, starts drawing all these military officers. And one of his superiors is even like, oh, these are pretty good. I've got a room in the back here. Why don't you just take that room and make it your studio? So he moves into the back room, and he's got his own studio in this POW camp, basically. So he's drawing and painting all these prisoners of war, and he's most likely, he does do some female nudes at this time as well, and they are a little bit fuller and more plump, and there's kind of these tones of motherhood and family that begun to sneak into his work as well at this time. You can imagine the isolation and being around all these men, especially somebody like Egon Schiele being around all these people. Obviously, he would not feel like he fit in once again. So he's starting to think about family and motherhood a little bit more. But all the female figures that he's drawing from this period also have a really lifeless and almost doll-like appearance too. So there's still that haunting quality at play there as well. But we have to remember, he's still showing while he's in the military. So he's going to be stationed in Prague for 2 years until 1917, and at which point, I guess his time is up, his tour is up, and he can go back to Vienna in 1917, and at this point, he's in full command of all his artistic talents and abilities, and he's really producing a tremendous amount of work, and he gets invited to all these different shows all throughout Europe, one of which is the 49th exhibition of the secessionist movement that was to take place in Vienna, where he was living. And Schiele would design the poster for this exhibition and create 50 different drawings that were also included in the main hall. And the exhibition was a great success, and this propelled his work, the value of his work, to new heights. And he starts getting all these new portrait commissions. So life is going really well for Egan, and then life throws him a curveball in the form of the Spanish flu epidemic that raged throughout all of Europe. And his wife, who was pregnant at the time, she'd be 6 months pregnant, she catches it, dies, then he would catch it and die 3 days later. So Egan was certainly somebody who was burning the candle at both ends, and he died extremely young, but the amount of drawings he did, the amount that he gave to the world, is still resonating to this day, and I invite all of you to take a look at some of the paintings that we've discussed in this episode, and just look at how they correlate so well to his life and so well to his story and what he wanted to do. Thanks a lot for listening, and if you're into this sort of thing, please head on over to oko.academy, which is my own little art school in Prague, where I teach painting, drawing, and individual lessons. If you're interested in that sort of thing, then you can sign up for a class with me. Thanks a lot for listening, and as always, happy painting.